This is Friday, October 30th, 2020. This interview for the Veterans Oral History Project, based at the Morris Institute Library in Natick, Massachusetts, is being recorded via Zoom. My name is Maureen Sullivan, Project Coordinator, and we're happy to have with us today James Ramsey. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Maureen. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Thank you. May I ask when you were born?
Yes, I was born November 27, 1943.
And where were you born?
Kansas City, Missouri.
What community do you currently reside?
Lexington, Massachusetts.
Your marital status?
I'm married, have been married to my wife Barbara for 54 years.
Do you have children?
Yes, I have two sons, David and John, age 46 and 43, respectively.
Do you have grandchildren?
Yes, I have five, ranging in age from 9 to 18. Their names are Reuben, Errol, Zephyr, Daniel, and Lena, respectively.
And tell us about life in Kansas City growing up.
Well, I guess I had a pretty normal childhood. I have a sister, Gail, who's 3 years younger than I. So we grew up together there. We lived in several different homes in Kansas City. We attended public schools. And I didn't quite make it through high school there in my junior year. We actually, the family really pretty much uprooted itself and moved to New Jersey. So I suddenly became an Easterner.
What did your dad do for a living?
My dad was a civil engineer, interestingly, which is what I studied in school. He was the chief engineer for the water department of Kansas City, Missouri. And that's what he was doing up until the time we departed.
Now, Jim, you grew up during the time of the Korean War and the Cold War. What were you being taught in schools about that?
Well, you know, I don't remember many specifics, Maureen, but I certainly do remember, I guess, the concerns. I do remember going through drills from time to time in school where the students were told to shelter under their desks in the event of a nuclear attack. I'm not sure how much good that would have done us actually in that event, but sure. I mean, it was prevalent. You know, fortunately, I guess being still young, probably it was a little more remote to us as kids than it probably was to our parents.
Okay. And when did you graduate from high school?
I graduated from high school in Westfield, New Jersey, in 1961.
And what did you do after that?
Well, I went to Cornell University to study civil engineering.
And I understand that you also joined the Navy ROTC.
I did. I decided really after I got to Cornell, don't remember the specifics, but probably during the orientation process when I learned about the various ROTCs that were available, it just occurred to me that joining ROTC and the Navy would be a good way to serve my country. So that's when I decided to do it. And so I was in the Naval ROTC program at Cornell really through my time there. That's essentially, ROTC is essentially, in a way, basic training, if you will, for a naval officer or one form of that. So,
What was your experience in the ROTC like? Did you do drills and study and stuff?
Well, basically, it was a combination of sort of military exercises like drills, Yes, we did do drills. We formed up into units. I guess our unit was a battalion, so of the Naval ROTC people, and so we would drill and march and so forth. But the main activity was really studies that kind of paralleled our academic studies. It was called naval science. So in naval science, we learned about naval operations, we learned about engineering, we learned about weapons, we learned about strategy. And so I one of my courses throughout the time of Cornell was called naval science. I had naval science basically every semester. And through that, I learned about what it would be like to be in the Navy. Pretty deep background. I mean, that's 4 years of, I guess, essentially 8 semesters of courses. So
that must have been quite a course load.
Quite a what? Sorry.
Quite a course load.
It was. Well, it's demanding because, of course, it's on top of the regular, already pretty demanding course load that I took of civil engineering, but it was fine. I made it through it okay.
Okay. When did you graduate from Cornell?
I graduated in June of 1966. When I entered Cornell, it was a 5-year engineering, Bachelor of Engineering program. In my senior year, Cornell changed it, made it a 4-year program. So basically, but since I was there for 5 years, I wound up going ahead with the 5th year and getting a master's degree in civil engineering. I was fortunate, during my freshman year in the Naval ROTC, I decided I had the opportunity to apply for what's called the regular Naval ROTC program. And such that thereafter, for the rest of my time at Cornell, the Navy basically paid all of my tuition, books, et cetera. For that, I had to commit to 4 years of service after graduation, which is what I did commit to. I actually wound up serving 5 years because of the Vietnam War, basically, but my commitment was 4.
Okay, so let's get you back to June of 66. You've gotten your diploma. I'm assuming you received a commission.
I did, all at the same time, right.
Okay, so tell us what happened afterward.
Well, I went to basically, I guess you could call it advanced training. I went to the Civil Engineer Corps Officers School in Port Hueneme, California. And all Civil Engineer Corps officers, wherever they come from, basically have to go, it was called CECOS, acronym, and we were there for 2 to 3 months. And the purpose of that was to really learn how to learn about the whole process of managing, building and managing the Navy's facilities. Because that's what Civil Engineer Corps officers really do, is responsible for all of the naval facilities worldwide.
Okay.
Building them, maintaining them, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So Jim, Vietnam's kind of picking up at this point. What were you being told about Vietnam?
Well, that's interesting. So yes, it was kind of picking up at this point. And then in 1966, moving into 1967, things were absolutely heating up. So what all of us were being told or knew was that it was likely that we would probably, that we would wind up in Vietnam at some point. One of the duties, or one of the jobs, if you will, of Civil Engineer Corps officers is leadership responsibility within the Navy Seabees. And the Navy Seabees, or construction battalions, which really started in the Second World War, mm-hmm. working with the Marines as they landed on the various islands. The Seabees build facilities for the Marines. The Marines fight, the Seabees build. And the Seabees do a little fighting too, if they have to. So one of the three major responsibilities of Civil Engineer Corps officers is some sort of leadership role in a CB battalion, or that's very likely that they would do that. So therefore, particularly for me, with, you know, 4 years of obligation, it was not unlikely that I would wind up going to Vietnam.
Okay. So what was your rank at this time?
At the time of, say, exiting the Civil Engineer Corps Officer School, I was an ensign in the Navy.
And were you already married?
Yes, Barbara and I were married in really right after, like 2 days after graduation, so, and commissioning. So was married, we took off from New Jersey, made our way to California to start life together and in the Navy.
Well, you kept busy.
it was, but we were young then, so it was fine.
So you're there 2 to 3 months. What happened after that?
Well, my first duty, my first duty station, my first tour, so to speak, was in Long Beach, California, not far away really from Port Hueneme. And that was the long title, but it was the Long Beach Area Resident Officer in Charge of Construction. And that's another broad duty type for Civil Engineer Corps officers. Essentially, that was, we were responsible for the construction of naval facilities at naval installations in the states, basically stateside. And so Long Beach at that time was a major naval kind of a region. I mean, there was a Long Beach Naval Station, there was a shipyard, there was hospitals. So our job, my title was Assistant Resident Officer in Charge of Construction. And so what I did was I essentially had responsibility to oversee the construction of naval facilities. And so in basically the year and a half or so that I was there, I had 20 or so projects that I was assigned to. I mean, over time, not all at the same time.
Right.
Ranging from barracks to utility facilities. And our job was to essentially manage the contractors, the civilian contractors, who were building these facilities. So what I did was spend a lot of time out on job sites, kind of monitoring the progress of work, working with the Navy civilian inspectors who were there on a daily basis, watching the progress of the work, occasionally problem solving, dealing with ambiguities in the plans and specs or some other problem that had to be solved, negotiating changes to contracts, et cetera. Basically, all aspects of construction contract management with the objective of making sure the thing got built on time and within budget. I mean, that was the basic goal.
And how long were you at this duty station?
I was there 18 to 20 months or so.
Okay.
And it was great. It was great responsibility. One thing I think that is true in general is that young naval officers get tossed into fairly significant military officers, probably generally, but certainly my experience in the Navy, you get handed a lot of responsibility. And so, and that was true throughout my time in the Navy, but it was certainly true in this job.
Okay. Tell me what happened after.
Well, after that, I remember it fairly vividly. One day, I guess at work, I got orders to join U.S. Naval Mobile Construction Battalion 62. which was one of the CB battalions I talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, okay. And I really didn't have much advance warning, although, as I said earlier in response to your question, I mean, I kind of knew it was probably coming, but this was going to be my ticket to Vietnam. And so I recall going home that night and going out with my wife for a pizza and showing her the orders that I'd received. And so we realized that we were headed off to a new Navy experience for us. I should mention just a little bit, well, I guess I did, but the CBs, again, which were started really in the early 40s in response to the war in the Pacific and the real need to, the Marines were invading or were, you know, basically trying to retake the islands that the Japanese had occupied. And so every one of those landings required some sort of facility support, building airfields or barracks or living quarters for the Marines. And so in very short order, the CBs were started, the construction battalions were started from scratch. The Navy basically hired experienced construction people from civilian life, gave them very quick training in military life and combat, and then basically sent them off to build for the Marines. So that's, you know, at the time, I guess, perspective, at the time that I was in, which I joined the CB battalion in 1968, I guess I was probably 25 years after the first CBs did their thing in the Pacific.
I've had the honor of interviewing several CBs, and believe me, their jobs wasn't exactly beer and Skittles.
Oh, I have to put in a plug here for a good friend of mine.
Go right ahead.
Who's no longer with us, and that's Charlie Bevilacqua. Mm-hmm. You know Charlie.
I know Charlie.
Because I know he did an interview with you, but Charlie was a good friend. He passed away within the past year. But importantly, Charlie did great things with the CBs, including being part of the first, expedition to develop facilities in Antarctica, down at McMurdo Bay. But Charlie was a good friend, but Charlie also was at one point the Master Chief Petty Officer of the Seabees, meaning that he was the senior enlisted person in the whole Seabees worldwide. Mm-hmm. So he was good.
He was very good.
So anyway, so back to me.
Back to you.
So I joined the CB. So what we, the CB battalions were at that time all really mostly deploying to Vietnam. They have home ports, just like a ship does, I guess. Our home port was Gulfport, Mississippi. So at the time in the spring of 1968, at that time, the CB, my battalion, MCB 62, was deployed to Vietnam. So my wife and I first went to Mississippi to basically find housing there. My wife Barbara decided that she would stay in Mississippi alone, at least while I was gone, rather than say, go to her parents' home or whatever. I really appreciated her staying there and holding down the fort, so to speak. In any event, we went to Gulfport. I was there for a few weeks to get, indoctrinated a bit. And then I flew from there to, Da Nang, South Vietnam, to join MCB 62, Mobile Construction Battalion 62.
So tell us about your first days in Vietnam, and especially at Da Nang.
To say the least, it was a it was a change of pace. My responsibility, when I joined the battalion, and I joined it about halfway through the deployment to Da Nang. Deployments were typically 8 months long. So I basically joined 4 months in, had 4 months left. My responsibilities then were as the battalion's, I guess, headquarters company commander and administrative officer. So I was in charge of administrative and personnel matters for the battalion. By the way, the battalions typically had 750 or so CBs. Carpenters, steel workers, electricians, plumbers, et cetera, all kinds of facilities. I guess I landed in a Navy jet. Well, actually it wasn't, it was a civilian plane, I guess, that had been, but it was taking obviously mostly military people. It was, well, everything about it was strange, certainly. I mean, I was, I'd been trained a bit, but all of this was new to me. So I guess I found the battalion at its headquarters. I signed in. I quickly learned that while, as I said before, the CB's main job is to build, but secondarily it's to fight. Pretty much anywhere one was in Vietnam, we were subject to rocket and mortar attacks, typically at night. And so certainly not long after I was there, I was indoctrinated in the proper procedures for protecting oneself in the event of such an attack, which typically meant finding a bunker or something to get into. And, hope for the best. But I got to know the people, the commanding officer, all the folks were great. And it seemed relatively effortless to get into my responsibilities as the administrative officer. So.
Okay, at the time you were deployed to Vietnam, were you still an ensign?
No, I guess in 67 I was promoted to lieutenant junior grade, which is the second level rank for officers, naval officers.
Mm-hmm. And you just mentioned you got indoctrinated with mortar fire and got more familiar with life in Vietnam for that. But before the interview, you mentioned a bridge.
Right. Well, that was right. And we can, the CBs doing construction, and much of this construction that the CBs did in Vietnam, supporting mostly the Marines, although Army too, had to do with basically roads and bridges. A good transportation network is really essential to the fighting forces, being able to resupply the troops in remote bases required good roads, good bridges, and because the CB and the infrastructure, obviously, in Vietnam was not fully suited, certainly, to the kind of military requirements that we had. So that was a big deal. So in Da Nang, the battalion was building a bunch of different things. The bridge part of it came during my second deployment. Mm-hmm. We can move fairly quickly through this first one. Everything was good. We lost a few CBs. Actually, we lost 3 CBs in one night. Mentioned these rocket mortar attacks. One rocket attack, unfortunately, made a direct hit on a living quarters CBs and killed 3 of them as they slept. And, that was the sort of thing that kind of the uncertainty associated with that. But again, for the most part, we were fine. And so after 4 months, actually not long after I arrived, in Da Nang, there was a change of command ceremony at the battalion. And I'm mentioning this because the commanding officer coming in was a remarkable fellow, leader, and someone whom I was really privileged to basically spend most of my time serving when I was in the battalion. His name was John Paul Jones Jr., of all things, quite a fabled name. He was a commander. Typically, Navy commanders are the ones who command PB battalions. So he came in at that point, and I can talk more about him with regard to our work later. But so after 4 months in Da Nang, the battalion had good success with its projects. We came back to Gulfport, came back all at once. I mean, multiple flights, but basically the whole battalion deploys, you know, goes home, deploys back again as a unit. So we got back to, probably November or so of 1968, got back to Gulfport. And in Gulfport, in home port, not only is there a chance to rest up some, but there's also a real need to do training to prepare for the next deployment. Training in terms of military, combat training, there was plenty of that, just in case we had to actually get in combat. Each CV battalion is organized like a Marine battalion with companies. Mm-hmm. Basically, the main organizational unit is a company. Only unlike the Marines, the companies and the CBs have mainly a construction function. So when not long after, actually about the time we came back to Gulfport, I was basically told that I was selected to be a company commander in the next deployment. The company I had was Charlie Company. So Charlie Company had mainly or really totally steel workers and what were called builders, which were really carpenters, concrete masons, etc. So that was my responsibility really at the start of home port. And so my main job over the next 6 months was to just get to know my battalion, my company, and to get familiarized with the projects that we would be doing, because there had been advanced planning to define the major projects for the next deployment, and to do combat training. Each company was organized also as a combat unit. So one of our platoons, a couple of platoons were rifle platoons. The steel workers were a heavy weapons, a machine gun, and et cetera, platoon. So combination of construction training and combat training, and a good chance to get rested up a little bit. So we were in Gulfport for 6 months. Mississippi was actually an interesting place to live. Barbara and I certainly wouldn't have been at the top of our list of places to move to. But as I said, Barbara stayed, so it was just wonderful to be able to come home in November and find her there. And she had set up housekeeping, and so we had a very interesting time in the Deep South. Certainly expanded our horizons in that way, which was a good thing.
So
then we were ready to go back. Did you want to ask me something?
No, nope, go right ahead.
After 6 months, so we were back in the spring, I think it was April 1969, the battalion deployed again as a unit back to Vietnam. And of course, you can imagine folks, enlisted folks and officers are, you know, typically are assigned to a battalion for a year and a half, maybe 2 years. So during the home port time, there's a fair amount of turnover, people coming in, people leaving. So, but the whole unit, again, with a lot of equipment and all the rest of it, returned to Vietnam. This time we were, our base of operations was the town of Dong Ha, Vietnam, which is north of Da Nang. Da Nang is in the northern part of Vietnam, to be sure. Dong Ha is considerably farther north than that. Dong Ha is about 10 miles south of the demilitarized zone between North and South Vietnam. And that's where, that's was also where the US 3rd Marine Division was headquartered, at a big combat base in Dong Ha. And that's where our battalion was headquartered too, because we were there primarily to support the 3rd Marine Division.
Tell us a little more about that part of Vietnam. Was it mountainous, jungle?
There was a lot of topography to it. There were mountains, not really tall mountains. This was in Dong Ha, it's in Quang Tri province. You may have heard that, you know, town, there's a city called Quang Tri, which is, I think, the major city in that, in the province, the northernmost province in Vietnam. And so it, somewhat mountainous and hilly. Historically, the area was, I think, a beautiful area, lush, a lot of vegetation, trees, flowers, etc. Agent Orange did its best to pretty much wipe all of that out. And so by, so we were basically, most of the vegetation, or a lot of the vegetation, had departed by the, you know, when we were there. And so it was a little less attractive.
And what were your main duties and what were the main projects?
Well, we were, again, especially up in Dong Ha, our main, much of what the whole battalion was doing was associated with improving the road and bridge network. There were a bunch of, there were a number of Marine fire bases, combat bases, in the vicinity of Dong, basically to the north and west of Dong Ha. And all of those, and one of them that many people will know, is Khe San. It was much farther west. It was way out there. But there must, I don't really, there may have been 20 bases of, you know, smaller units of Marines. And all of those bases had to be served by roads, bridges, and those bridges and roads had to be able to support, at times, very heavy duty traffic, either tanks or trucks carrying supplies to the Marines. And so, one of the issues with the road system is that it was susceptible to damage, demolition attempts by the enemy. We had the North Vietnamese in the area. We had the Viet Cong in the area, you know, the local South Vietnamese insurgents working with the North Vietnamese. And one of their, you know, principal activity, well, they were disrupting, you know, military activities, either by directly attacking or, you know, sending rocket and mortar attacks in, or trying to destroy bridges and damage roads such that they were unusable. So we were either repairing, replacing, or building new road and bridge facilities primarily.
And how long were you deployed to that area?
8 months.
8 months.
I guess just to talk a little bit about specifics, the two main projects that the battalion had during that 8 month deployment were two bridges. One was called the Camlo Bridge, close to the town of Camlo, which was about 7 miles west of Don Ha. And the other was the Don Ha Bridge, which was a bridge, really Route 1 was the major north-south road, really going all the way, I believe, up to Hanoi and all the way down to Saigon. Pardon me, the Don Ha Bridge was essentially was part of the Route 1 network close to Don Ha. Those two bridges, one of them, the Don Ha Bridge, replaced an old French built truss bridge that was really shaky and unreliable. And the Camlo Bridge replaced a bridge over the same river, the Camlo River, which had been washed out in the previous season's monsoon. And both of those were really critical to serving a bunch of bases. So those were our two major projects, the battalion's project. My company, Charlie Company, its main project, which we basically started as really as soon as we hit the ground, was the Camlo Bridge. This was a 460-foot steel bridge that we essentially built from scratch alongside a pontoon bridge that the Marines had built once the other one had gotten washed away. But the pontoon bridge was, you know, barely kind of serviceable and needed replacement with a full-time structure. So we started that, our company, the steel workers, to build the carpenters, the masons, it's a concrete and steel bridge that we completed in 4 months, less than 4 months. Our assignment was to complete it by pretty much the end of July 1969, and we completed it, I think, by July 5th or something, a few weeks ahead of schedule. So it was a good project.
You mentioned that some of the CBs were trained to be combat units. While this bridge was under construction, were some of the CBs or the Marines acting as protection?
Yes, good. That's a good question. Basically, around the perimeter of the, or basically for the kind of four quarters, four points around the bridge, guard towers were erected by the CBs, and those guard towers were manned by Marines. And so that was, you know, one, you know, kind of a fundamental protection. Essentially, what we had to set up a construction camp in the vicinity of Camlo to build this bridge. It's too far away for people to be traveling to every day, and probably too dangerous. So we set up a camp where a certain number of the CBs who were working on site basically lived out there. And so they had to, so they were, again, I mean, we had at least the Marines that were manning these guard towers, you know, who were there to deter the enemy in the event of some kind of action, or certainly alert people. There were enemy attacks. I mean, occasionally, not enemy troops invading per se, but there were occasional rocket and mortar attacks there to try to disrupt things.
And in case any personnel were sick or injured or wounded, were there medical facilities available?
There was some basic medical capability at the construction camp. But in the event of some medical problem, it was relatively easy to transport them back to Don Ha Again, it's only 7 miles. And there was a hospital, or certainly a field hospital in Dong Ha, that could treat them.
And at your camp itself, did you have like dining facility, latrines, what have you?
At the construction camp?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, okay. There was a dining facility of sorts. I mean, it was really pretty rustic. It was rustic living. I have to say that I, because I, as company commander, had a number of other projects that I was also responsible for. That was our main one, but we were doing a number of other projects simultaneously. I actually was living in Dong Ha at the main camp. Mm-hmm. We had, a deployment. We had, another officer who worked for me, who was on site at the project, and then a bunch of the enlisted folks. But yeah, we took pretty good care of them, I believe.
And what did you ever have any interaction with the local population?
Sorry, there was a little interruption.
Okay, I'm sorry. Did you ever interact with the local population?
Some, but not much. We occasionally, there was local, some of the local folks were engaged, it actually helped us with some of the construction. This bridge, interestingly, that we built was actually turned over to the South Vietnamese government not long after we finished it. It was still used primarily for our military traffic, but it was turned over to the South Vietnamese. So we had some South Vietnamese helping us on the project. But in terms of, going into town, for instance, going into Dong Ha, there really wasn't much of that. That sort of activity wasn't really encouraged. And there were Vietnamese on the base, kind of working, employed in some cases, but generally not much interaction.
What about recreation?
Well, we had it pretty good, really. Certainly we had it good, relative to those who were in more remote outposts. Basically at night we had good eating, in the ward room. That's where the officers, that's the dining room. That's what the dining room for naval officers is called. We had movies that we could watch at night. There was a recreation area. There was pool, I recall. I do like to play pool some. There was a pool table, so that was a very, and ping pong, that sort of thing. So there was books. There was a small, a library type of thing. There was also a fair emphasis, I think music always is important. And so I recall having purchased, I guess, a tape player, and the Navy, we had a big library of tapes, which we could make copies of and play them ourselves. So there was a good opportunity for rest and recreation.
Okay, so the bridge was finished a little ahead of schedule. Tell us what happened next.
Well, what happened next was really just continuing with, the pace of construction activity was really great. We had many, many assignments all throughout this 8-month tour. So basically what happened next was more construction. We wound up a major kind of category of construction from that, really throughout the deployment, was replacing smaller bridges, culverts, that are used, sections of pipe that are used to provide drainage that go under highways. Typically the enemy would try to destroy or put explosives in a culvert. That would then not only destroy the culvert, but also the road surface right above it. So we had to do a lot of those kinds of repairs responsibly, quickly, so that traffic could get going on the road again. We did, we built housing facilities, we built landing, built a big landing pad on the river. I guess it was the Camlo River, where, you know, naval, you know, small naval craft could land and be resupplied. We had to build that. We had some real problems with that. It kept, the ground underneath the concrete was not stable. So we kept, our concrete kept getting washed away. And finally, we decided, and part of my problem solving responsibility, I guess, was to come up with, you know, try to solve problems like this. So we came up with a plan to basically put in sheet piling along basically at the river's edge, so that the river would be, the water would be kept out and we could let the concrete cure. So that was an example of a you know, a project. But there was a ton of projects working right up to the end.
Okay, Jim, you mentioned earlier in the interview about the Commander John Paul Jones Jr. And it was said that he may have, he had something to do with one of your projects. Suppose you can go into a little more detail about that.
Well, he had, John Paul Jones was a great leader. And so he was always out sort of on the projects. I mean, part of his job, I mean, the company commander was really had the most direct responsibility for the projects he was doing, but the commanding officer of the battalion was out too. So he would always be out looking at projects, offering advice, guidance, et cetera. There was no specific interaction. I do remember one time when on the other big bridge that I mentioned we built, another company built, the Dong Ha Bridge, there was a major storm and there was a piece of construction, a floating construction equipment on a barge, like a crane.
All right.
And John Paul Jones, this was on a weekend. No, I don't think construction crews were around, but he was out there looking at the job with the operations officer, and the barge broke loose from its mooring. And so either John Paul Jones or the operations officer or both somehow got in the water themselves, retrieved the line that was mooring the craft and somehow got it secured again. But I mean, I guess that illustrates the fact that he was, I mean, he was the boss and all of that, but he was a man of action for sure.
Definitely.
He was a great commanding officer, really due to his leadership. MCB 62 was recognized really for both of our deployments to Da Nang and Dong Ha as the best CB battalion in the Navy. It's something called the Peltier Award. Under his leadership, the battalion got that award among all the CB battalions in the country both years. And I should say, by the way, that just as a point of interest, at the height of the Vietnam War, which was really around the time that I happened to be there, there were 20 plus CB battalions deployed to Vietnam. At one point, I think that there were something like 11,000 CBs, really all over Vietnam, mm-hmm. doing basically this same kind of thing. So it was a very significant effort as, you know, part of the Navy's activities.
Before the interview, you mentioned one of the bridges and what happened to it, I believe, was after your deployment.
Well, yes, that actually is a spectacular story, which I'll briefly recount. The Dong Ha Bridge, interestingly, which is the other bridge, so to speak, that I mentioned. As I said, it was a really vital link on the main North-South Highway and all of Vietnam, right at Dong Ha. In the spring of 1972. So fast forward 3 years. By the way, I should, just for reference, and it's pretty interesting thinking about this in hindsight, I didn't really know what was going on at the time. But as it turned out, just about the time we were departing Vietnam in the fall of 1969, President Nixon had announced the whole principle of Vietnamization, which was turning the fighting responsibilities in South Vietnam over to the South Vietnamese. So in fact, when we left in 1960, by the time 69 was over, the 3rd Marine Division had left the whole division of the Marines. The CBs had pretty much left. And all of that military responsibility was taken over by the South Vietnamese army. And so that's just an important backdrop for the story, because what happened in the intervening 3 years is that for several reasons, the North Vietnamese became emboldened to think that they could invade the South. Ultimately, they did successfully in 1975, which is when they took over. But the first attempt at that was in 1972. And in the spring of 72, North Vietnam launched the Easter Offensive in April, really very close to Easter Sunday. And they basically sent, I think, a dozen divisions, essentially the entire North Vietnamese army, into several different parts of South Vietnam to basically take over the country. In the north, where this bridge was, that was the main focus of their attack. I mean, it's closest to North Vietnam. So they came right over the DMZ, which actually they'd never done before. Most of the incursions from North Vietnam, and probably what were called the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos. They would come down through Laos and then infiltrate in from the west. But now most of them came right over the DMZ. And so how were they gonna come in? How were they gonna get into South Vietnam? Well, they were hoping to use the road network. And the Dong Ha Bridge was a major bridge that stood in their way. And taking that would have allowed them to not only get to Dong Ha, but also Quang Tri City. And ultimately their objective was Hue, which was the former imperial capital and a very important town, both symbolically and in fact for South Vietnam. So on April 2nd, 1972. Again, so there were essentially no U.S. forces. A lone Marine battalion, a Vietnamese Marine battalion, was sent up from Quang Tri to Dong Ha to try to somehow stop this massive North Vietnamese offensive. And again, they had one single division was coming down Route 1 towards Dong Ha on that day, a division. 15,000 troops against a battalion of South Vietnamese Marines. The advisor to that battalion, U.S. advisor, was a guy named Marine Captain John Walter Ripley. And over the course of that day, somehow Ripley single-handedly managed. He had some demolitions training. He was a super Marine, gone through all the training. He managed to deploy a bunch of explosives out on the bridge, the Dong Ha Bridge, the bridge that our battalion had built 3 years earlier, with the objective of demolishing it, because that was the only way that the North Vietnamese offensive could have been stopped. Captain Ripley deployed the explosives. He was assisted by someone, but he went the only one out on the bridge. And in the span of about 4 hours, 5 hours maybe, deployed the explosives, successfully detonated them and took out the south span of the bridge, which was all they had to do, and the North Vietnamese could not make it over. This was just, the North Vietnamese tanks were stationed at the north end of the bridge. They were all ready to go, and somehow he destroyed it. So it basically stalled the invasion, stalled the progress of the invasion enough so that South Vietnamese could regroup, and they managed ultimately, I mean, the North Vietnamese did a lot of damage, but it basically stopped them short of their goal, such that they basically had to come back 3 years later and finally take over. So for his action, Captain Ripley was awarded the Navy Cross, which is the second only to the U.S. Medal of Honor. And he had a distinguished Marine career after that. He retired as a colonel. He died about 10 years ago. But
wow,
he did some great stuff. So,
okay, back to you. You and your unit left Vietnam in the fall of 69. Tell us what happened.
We left in fall of 69. We came back to Gulfport one more time. And so that ended my time in the Seabees. I guess at that point, so I had completed, I completed 3.5 years of my 4-year obligation. And at that point, I was given an opportunity to basically leave the CB battalion and go to one more duty station if I was willing to extend my tour, my time in the Navy by 1 year. I was given an opportunity to go to San Diego and based to the San Diego Naval Station and, you know, continue doing my civil engineer corps duties there. I think I could have elected to stay in the Seabees and leave at the end of my 4 years, but I think that would have involved my having to go back to Vietnam a third time. And I said San Diego, Vietnam. San Diego was an easy choice, even if it meant another year. So, yeah.
So what was your rank at the time now?
I was promoted to lieutenant in, I think, on July 1st, 1969. So at the time I left the battalion, I was lieutenant, basically the third rung on the officer ladder for the Navy. So.
And you stayed in San Diego for the whole year?
Well, yes, it was actually a year and a half. We left Mississippi in December, got to San Diego after taking some leave in January of 1970. And I was in San Diego from there that time until June of 71 when I left. So I left just about exactly 5 years after I started. And in San Diego, my duties were basically the third, leg of the Civil Engineer Corps officer stool. I was basically involved in, my title was Staff Civil Engineer of the Naval Station. The San Diego Naval Station is a huge naval facility, basically home port for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. And so many ships, buildings, all kinds of utilities, et cetera. And so as Staff Civil Engineer, my responsibility was really distinct of a local public works function. We were responsible primarily for maintaining upkeep of all the facilities on the base, occasionally new construction. So unlike the first two tours, which involved really building things, the public works function is really a task of maintaining them, looking over, watching, making sure the facilities are always equipped, are always in the right condition to do the job they were designed to do. So I basically did that for a year and a half.
Jim, you mentioned before the interview that you were wounded but not in combat. Can you explain?
Yes, thanks, Maureen. Yes, kind of unusual. I was out one day in my Jeep visiting a job site, and I felt something hit my face. I knew that I had been struck by a projectile of some kind. So it turned out that this was not from the enemy, it was from the U.S. Marines. They had apparently detonated a Claymore mine, which consists of a whole bunch of small metal pellets. And one of those pellets, I guess I was a little too close to it by accident. So one of those pellets struck me in the face. I basically made my way back to the base medical facilities, and they treated me. It's a souvenir of the war that I carry with me today, and I'm basically fine, so thank you.
Okay, was this during your first deployment or second deployment?
It was during the second deployment in Dong Ha. I was out visiting one of my company's projects, and that's when it happened. So,
you're out of the Navy in June of 71. Did you receive any medals or commendations?
Yes, I did. I guess one of the benefits of serving in a combat zone is that is often an opportunity for the awarding of decorations. I received a number of medals and ribbons, which I believe I've given you kind of the information of that. Probably, well, certainly the one that's most important to me is the Navy Commendation Medal, which I received for my role as company commander of Charlie Company in 1969. The completion, the bridge work, all the work that our company did, I guess they have to give the credit officially somewhere, and so the company commander got it. But there were 90 CBs who did the work, so credit to them.
All right. So before we set you back to civilian life, is there anything that comes to mind about your experience in the Navy, any memorable characters?
Well, I've told you about one of them. And by the way, I never knew John Ripley. I mean, this all happened after I was there. The story is a pretty cool one, though. Mm-hmm. John Paul Jones, obviously. I guess I think back my first tour in Long Beach. I was a fresh ensign. I knew civil engineering, but I didn't really know construction. The head of our group, the resident officer in charge of construction, was a commander named Fred Briggs. And he was really a good guy. And he gave me a lot of responsibility. I would just say it's just amazing what you can do if it's for somebody who believes in you. He got me off to the best possible start. And there were some other really good people. The civilian engineers and contractors were such nice people. Ralph Stoll, Cliff Goddard, they got me off to the best possible start. I guess I've been thinking about this recently because, of course, we're celebrating the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II. We're also celebrating, whether we know it or not, the 75th anniversary of the end of the Battle of the Bulge, which I think was in early 1945. It started in 44. One of the inspectors on a big project of mine in Long Beach was a guy named Milt Horn. And Milt was a great guy, and we would always have good conversations. But Milt was an Army veteran, and he fought in the Battle of the Bulge. And at that time, of course, again, it was 20, you know, not much more than 20 years after that battle. So it was pretty fresh. Wasn't fresh to me. I mean, I knew nothing really about it. But I've been thinking lately that, number one, Milt wasn't completely there. It was very clear. He talked about the Battle of the Bulge and about he fought in, I think I mentioned that, he fought in that battle. But it did some damage to Mel. And he would talk, not physical, I'm just talking really about, we call it PTSD today. I really don't know. I can't diagnose him. But he talked about how hard it was. And at the time, I listened and whatever, but I have more appreciation of Milt now. So that was important.
I guess it's a good time to lead up to what you're doing now. You're a volunteer with the Bedford VA Medical Center.
Right. Eight years ago, I signed on as a volunteer at the Bedford VA Hospital, working in the out of the library there. There's a small library that basically serves two functions. One is to provide access to information for the staff, doctors, nurses, et cetera, basically medical information. But the other is stuff to give to the veterans there, library materials, books, magazines, et cetera. The Bedford VA is really, for the most part, a long-term care facility, nursing home for vets. There are probably 300 beds there, not all filled, of course, that serve that function. So basically for 8 years, I've been taking my library card around, filled with books and magazines and audiobooks, movies, music, everything, taking them to veterans and long-term care in the hospital. I like to say I bring books and companionship to the vets, because as in most nursing homes, and certainly it's the case with Bedford, many of the veterans spend a lot of time alone. Some of them have families close by, many don't. Of course, now in the time of COVID, it's especially tough because they're really isolated. Nobody can, we can't visit them anymore. But anyway, I've been doing this. I've made a lot of friendships. It's been, I have to say, it's really the best job I've ever had. It's very important in my life.
Yeah. And for those who are regular viewers of the Oral History Project may know Jim, because he's been a big help to the project. He's interviewed several veterans at the VA Center.
Right. That has been, I think I was thinking about that this morning, Maureen, and I think the first one of those was in early 2018, which is coming up on 3 years.
Yep.
And that has been, I think I've done probably 10 of those over there. Mm-hmm. And these were all of veterans who I had gotten to know at the hospital beforehand. But it was just a wonderful thing for me to be able to speak to them, to hear their stories, and to help with this great project that you're doing, because I do think it's great. And I know that it made a big difference to the veterans to be able to tell their story. It's been great.
Well, it's been great for you to help us along.
Well, thank you for that opportunity. I can say that for sure.
All right, Jim, let's get back to you being a Vietnam veteran yourself. How has public perception of the Vietnam War changed over the past half century?
Oh, I would say dramatically. I was certainly aware. I mean, by the time when I was in Vietnam in 68 and 69, I mean, that was the height of political unrest in this country related to Vietnam. And so, I mean, I was aware of all of that. I mean, I was out of the country through those, for much of those critical years, but certainly aware. And I was aware, in my own experience, I was fortunate not to have suffered any sort of direct impact in terms of abuse by folks who really disrespected a number of the folks in the military at the time and gave them a hard time. I didn't experience that, but I was certainly aware of it. So it's night and day, because the country has, you know, it is, you know, celebrating. We're in the middle of a multi-year sort of celebration, so to speak, of the 50-year celebration of the Vietnam War. The country is, you know, the president, I mean, under really Obama, and then now with President Trump, you know, recognizing the veterans. And I think in towns like Lexington, taking steps to, at times, to recognize veterans of the Vietnam War without necessarily, you know, there's a kind of a dichotomy. There's seems to be a general acceptance of the fact that the war was, well, was a misguided effort, and there were problems, lots of problems and mistakes made. But I think that those who fought in it are being given their due, fully given their due, mm-hmm. in most parts of this country. So that's a really good thing.
Okay. We're going to just jump back a little bit. What did you do for your civilian career after you left the Navy?
Well, I immediately upon leaving the Navy, I enrolled at Harvard Business School. I had the sense that it would be a good thing for me to augment my engineering training and experience with some business education as well. So I wound up after that, a couple of years of that, spending my career really in a business, in business. I worked primarily in marketing and business development, and primarily for technical companies or companies who sold technical products, you might say industrial type marketing companies. So I was always able to, my engineering background was always a help dealing with technical stuff, but I was more from the marketing, kind of came at it more from the marketing end in terms of the work that I did. So good combination.
Good. So, Jim, how important was it for you to serve in the military?
Well, I cannot overstate the importance in my life. The decision I made in 1961 to join Naval ROTC, which was, I wouldn't say it was made in haste, but it wasn't made with a huge amount of thought, was probably the best decision, well, one of the best decisions of my life. My decision to marry Barbara was certainly the best decision of my life. But the time in the Navy itself was a great experience for me. But the real fact is that things have kind of come full circle for me. I've described my activities at the VA hospital, volunteering. I'm very active in veterans stuff because I also am a member of the Lexington Veterans Association, and I'm on the executive committee of that group. And we meet monthly. We have presenters talk on about military history and that sort of thing. And it's a great group, very active, a lot of veterans. I mean, the main audience, our members, are veterans. And so in that, I've had a chance to meet many veterans and also get involved in veterans, other veterans activities in town of Lexington. So I guess I would say that really for the past 10 years, you know, 8 at the VA and a couple before that with the Lexington Veterans Association, I've really gotten heavily involved and committed to veterans activities. And so the fact is, of course, none of that would have happened had I not made that decision in September of 1961 to sign up. So it's been wonderful for my life.
Jim, is there anything else you would like to mention before we wrap up the interview? Perhaps you want to give the website address for the Lexington Veterans new website?
Oh, yes. good test, Maureen. Thank you. I think it is lexmavets.com. LexmaVets.com.
And according to you and the website, you can actually watch past programs. Is that correct?
Yes, that's a major feature. I told you that it's a lot like your website for all of your interviews. But we have gotten almost all of our past programs, and this is going back. The group has been in business since for 25 years, but since 2005, we've been recording them. And almost all of them are up on YouTube and available for viewing on our website. So it really is quite a treasure trove of information.
And I think that's a good way to wrap up this interview. Jim Ramsey, thank you so much for taking part in the Natick Veterans Oral History Project.
You're welcome. And thank you, Maureen. It's been a real pleasure.